And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls, our program about the ornithology and the avian world, made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundations and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your calls about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored over 70 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two young children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks so much for joining me tonight. There we go. And if you do have questions tonight and you'd like to ask Cliff those questions, you can give us a call again at 800-552-8502. Also, if you have any photos you would like to send us, you can send those to redriverradiomail@gmail.com, photos of birds, so that we can identify those. And we'll try to get those in and on the show this week. So, Cliff, we're going to refresh our listeners about last month's conservation tip. Give us a fill-in.
Yeah, at the end of every episode, we finalize the episode with a couple minutes of something to think about. We call it the conservation tip, something that we all can do to make the world a better place, especially for wild animals, for birds, for nature in general, and also for our pocketbook. We often tie these things back to being good on the pocketbook. So this one, it was on water conservation. And so we pointed out leaky pipes and automatic lawn sprinklers. I've got nothing wrong with lawn sprinklers, but if you're relying on them to work, when you know they're supposed to have this gauge that tells you when, or tells it when it's rained recently, so it doesn't come on. Those sometimes are faulty, so that's not good on your pocketbook. Why water when Mother Nature's watered, and leaky pipes? Why waste? So it's not that we're just wasting these waters; it's also wasting money in your pocketbook. So it's not only good for nature, for birds; it's good for your pocketbook. So we talked a little bit about what water conservation means in general, that, you know, there's things like freshwater inflow that's necessary on the Gulf Coast, and people that are in, for example, the shrimp industry are very dependent on freshwater to make it to the Gulf for shrimp production. So we also talked a little bit about reservoirs. You know, they might be great to boat and fish on, but think about the forest that's underneath, that's forever inundated under these reservoirs. So if we conserve water, maybe we wouldn't need to do extreme measures. But so when you're going on a reservoir, across the reservoir on a boat, and you see trees sticking up, that's because you're up at the canopy of former bottomland hardwood forest. So there are a lot of birds that would have been in that forest, and a lot of other critters. If you're a squirrel hunter, a duck hunter, those bottoms would have been really productive. A bird watcher, that's where ivory-billed woodpeckers once occurred. So it all ties back together, and the point is to think about these conservation issues and these tips that we give, and hopefully you can make it work at home and your business.
You are listening to Bird Calls tonight with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We invite you to call in with your questions about our avian world and birding in general at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff is ready to answer your questions tonight. And we're going to open up tonight with this month's bird spotlight. And what have you got for
us? Yeah, the red-bellied woodpecker. It's easily our listening area's most abundant woodpecker. It's found here year-round. Let's listen to two of their most common calls and drum. So we call that the queer or the chirr call, and you heard some drumming mixed in, and we'll talk about drumming at the end of this episode too. And then we have the chaw calls, that's somewhat reminiscent of coughing. Let's listen to that. And And so these two calls are the same species, red-bellied woodpecker, and they're very commonly heard. So we've profiled now over 20 different species. I've tried to pick those that are very ubiquitous to our listening area and very obvious to see or detect or to hear. So this one you can hear in a backyard easily or in the woods. So the red-bellied woodpecker, it's smaller than a blue jay. So we have 8 species of woodpeckers here. So don't think that we're talking about the pileated or something small like the downy. The pileated's very large, by the way. This is a mid-sized woodpecker. Again, the red-bellied woodpecker is smaller than a blue jay. It has a black and white zebra stripe back. It has no flowing crest, but the male does have a thin red strip of feathers from the base of the bill over the top of the head and then back down the nape. Think of it like a mohawk, but not long and tufty. The female has the same red, but only on the crown, proceeding down to the nape on the back of the head, so she lacks any red on the forehead. So the bird's name is peculiar since the red on the belly is very difficult to see because that patch of red is roughly about the size of a nickel, and it's usually pinned between the bird and the tree limb it's hugging. So you can't often see that. So people wonder why they call it red-bellied woodpecker. So, but like most woodpeckers, they're very omnivorous. They favor insects, but they'll eat whatever they can find that's in season, like acorns and pecans or a variety of berries. But they really like bugs and other invertebrates, especially those found on or under the bark of trees. To see a photo of a red-bellied woodpecker, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org for a great photo by James Childress of Lufkin. So the red-bellied woodpecker occurs throughout the entire eastern U.S., north to the southern Great Lakes, but it's creeping northward into southern Canada due probably to milder conditions and the help of backyard seed feeders. The species is also moving westward across the Great Plains as people have planted shade trees in the once vast grassland of our country's center swath. So this woodpecker nests during the spring and summer months in a cavity that the adults have excavated, usually in dead wood. So a cavity is a hollow. It takes the pair about 2 weeks to excavate that new cavity in dead wood. The female then lays 3 or 4 glossy white eggs atop a soft, cushiony pile of fine wood chips that are in the bottom of that cavity. Incubation for red-bellieds takes about 12 or 14 days, and young fledge around 3.5 weeks after hatching, but they'll continue to be fed by the parents that they'll follow around for several weeks as the young learn how to fend for themselves and to how to become self-sufficient. So the red-bellied woodpecker, let's listen one more time, Bill, to those calls. And I hear that one in my backyard all the time. In town, anywhere you have trees of size, they'll be red-bellied woodpeckers. They're in rural areas, they're in timberland. I mean, they're just all over the place, very abundant here. So I bet most of our listeners have heard this.
I've heard this many times.
and they're now, you know, we've just helped them. This has been bugging them for decades, and now they know what that bird is that they're hearing. Isn't that the great thing about this show, where you hear these things out in nature and you don't know what they are, and we try to solve those problems for you, and now you can sleep at night knowing that bird is a red-bellied woodpecker and you've heard it all your life.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight with anything about the avian world or birds in general at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Now, this week we did get a audio clip sent to us, and it was sent to us by Dennis K. Gibbons. And the audio clip, Cliff had identified as the great horned owl. Unfortunately, the owl in that clip was so far in the distance, it's really hard to hear. So what we're going to do is play you a surrogate here. And if you would like to hear Mr. Gibson's original recording, you'll have to do distant listening, as I said, through the ambient noise in the front. But you can hear this in the background.
And you'll hear that usually at dusk or in the night, and that's usually an immature bird that's begging for food. It's basically with that raspy note saying, feed me, mama, feed me, daddy, feed me, I'm hungry, feed me. So that's begging. That's what that bird's doing. So it's very different from the hoots that we're familiar with the great horned owl, the woo-hoo-hoo, woo-hoo, woo-hoo-hoo, woo-hoo, who's awake, me too. So that's the typical call of the great horned owl, but what we're listening to here is something that people hear and at dusk. They can't see anything. They might flush something big in the tree. They don't know what it is. So it's a young great horned owl that's fledged, but it's still dependent on mom and dad, and he's basically again saying, feed me, I'm hungry, come on, hurry, mama. So that we do encourage recordings of any kind. So as Bill mentioned, someone sent this in, and it was a little faint to play on the radio, but for Bill and I to hear as a sound file, it was fantastic. We could tell what it was, and we asked that also of photographs. If you want to send us a photograph, don't worry about it being cover quality for a magazine. If it's a little fuzzy or a little distant, chances are we'll be able to see what it is. Now, there have been some that are too fuzzy or too distant. We can't, you know, we try zooming in and it's too pixelated if it's not high res. But you don't have to send us stuff that you think is going to be worthy of the radio. So as Bill mentioned, that's a surrogate that we're playing, and we're acknowledging that on the website. So if you want to hear that again, you can go to the Bird Calls page and hear that. But that's the great horned owl.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 tonight. We have all lines open right now. And the Christmas bird count is just around the corner. And do you have a final tally or anything from last year's bird count?
I don't on the top of my head. I probably should, but, you know, this thing's been going on now. This will be the 117th year of the Christmas bird count. So it was started in exactly 1900, so it's easy to keep up with. But the count period this coming year is December 14th to January 5th. So we won't have another bird calls episode until after the Christmas bird count season is over. It's a 24-hour count from midnight to midnight, and it's a 15-mile diameter circle that's predetermined. There's a count compiler, which if you're interested in participating in a Christmas count, if you've never done it, you want to get in touch with the Christmas bird count compiler, that local compiler, because that person is in charge of divvying up the pie. So think of this 15-mile diameter circle as a pie or a pizza, and it's cut up into various shapes and sizes. And that compiler puts teams of bird watchers in these different pieces of the pie or pizza, because you want to avoid duplication and counting birds over, double counting, and you want to have greater coverage, so you spread the people out. So that's the really big part. Well, one of the big parts of the compiler. Another big part, of course, is ahead of time, getting all the paperwork and the data sheets ready to give out to their teams, and then receive the data and compile it to count everything from, you might have 15 bird watchers, but some of the counts are very big with hundreds of bird watchers, and that compiler has to then add things up. Okay, how many goldfinches did all the groups have? And make sure, okay, no overlap, so here's our number for American goldfinch. That might be very large. Or something in our area that might be small numbers like blue-gray gnatcatcher, gray catbird, or wide-eyed vireo. You know, we'll be lucky to get one or two on average of some of those birds. But they're a lot of fun. It's a really good way for bird watchers to get out in the field and work together as a team, and most importantly, to collect what we call citizen science data. And this is one of the longest, if not the longest, citizen science data collection of any kind on the planet. So it's a really good project to get involved in. There are lots of compilers in our listening area. People like Charlie Lyon here in Shreveport, who's been for a long time compiling the Shreveport count. David Wolf and Mimi Wolf, where I live in Nacogdoches, they compile the Lufkin Nat count. But if you're interested, I would encourage you to go to the Christmas Bird Count homepage. It's just christmasbirdcount.org. And scroll down, and on the right, about halfway down, it says, quote, join the Christmas Bird Count, end quote. And then you click on read more, and you see and click on something that says in blue font, it says a map view of the circles. And that's where you can find out if there's a circle near you. So if you're in Alexandria, there's some within short distance of you. If you're in Longview, there's several counts that David and Luann Brotherton compile. So there are a lot of really good people out there that are compiling these, and they're always looking for help. Some of the helpers can just be feeder watchers. If you have, for example, a hummingbird feeder up and you've been hosting a wintering hummingbird, they're going to want to hear from you because that's really exciting. We get a lot of rufous wintering with us, and blackshin, and occasionally ruby-throated and other species wintering with us. Other feeder watchers could be just, you know, watching your backyard bird feeder and sending in how many blue jays did you have, and chipping sparrows and pine siskins and so forth. So you don't have to really get out, but you just need to know where that circle is to make sure that you're indeed inside the circle, because we're playing by rules.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Anything having to do with birds or ornithology or our avian world is fair game. We go next to William from Longview. William, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
I was listening to the show and heard you play some calls of various woodpeckers, but we have a woodpecker in our backyard. It's very large, and I don't know what variety of woodpecker it is, but he makes a very unusual sound.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any bird calls for the is it a pileated woodpecker?
Yep.
Is that just...
Bill's firing up pileated woodpecker right now, and this is one
that's,
of several of its calls. Yep.
That's the sound. Okay.
Yep. That's our area's largest woodpecker. It's roughly crow size, not as husky and stout as a crow, and it's got a long flowing crest. And if you get a good look, you'll see that it could be the inspiration for Woody Woodpecker, the old cartoon. He looks a lot like that. And so that's one of eight species of woodpeckers we have. Since we're in a heavily forested area, we've got a really great diversity of woodpeckers here in the piney woods of East Texas and much of Louisiana. So yeah, that's the pileated woodpecker, and a pileum is a crest or a top notch. That's where that word comes from. It's Latin or Greek, I can't remember, but that's where the origin of the word. And they're pretty common and pretty cool. That's actually the bird that got me hooked as a bird watcher when I was a kid. So that's what I call my totem bird. That's very special to me. So William, I hope you like the pileated woodpecker, because he's one of my favorites.
Well, that's a very unusual sound. It almost sounds jungle-like.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, it sure does. And it makes some different calls, but the drumming is what's super loud on that one. And we'll talk a little bit more about drumming later, but in a nutshell, drumming is a form of communication. And so when you hear that, that's not a bird chiseling or feeding. He's found a very hollow limb or even a metal roof or a rain gutter, and he's trying to get that sound to resonate to cover more ground so more area can be heard, or birds in that greater area can hear that, hey, this is my home, keep out. You know, you and I put up fences. Birds have to use vocalizations to basically shout out a territory and defend it. So listen for the drumming of the pileated. And you hear drumming more in the pre-breeding season, which would be, you know, February and March and into the breeding season. But you can hear it year-round.
Well, I have another question.
Okay.
I'm having a problem with mockingbirds decimating my tomato garden. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, and that's not a current question, because I'm a big tomato grower, and I really love that time of the year. So right around the end of May, 1st of June, I get my first tomatoes, and then it's 6 or 8 weeks of heaven. Is that about what it is for you?
That's correct. I'm here in Longview, and that's...
Yeah.
Yes, that's about what it is. But lately, the mockingbirds have developed a appetite for my tomatoes, and they are really doing a job on them.
Okay, and yeah, I know that some people do grow fall tomatoes as well, and cherry tomatoes are just prolific. They'll grow up until the first freeze. So here's what I do. And I build up, I have a raised bed with tomato plants, and I put a big cage around it, like a girdle, to keep those wimpy tomato plants to grow up, because they just don't grow with any backbone, do they? And
right, that's correct.
On that cage, it's like a cattle pen on mine, and on that cage, I went to a craft store, and I bought some wooden balls about the size of an apple or a small orange, so not very big, but about the size of a baseball, let's go with that. And
okay,
I painted them red like a tomato. I drilled a hole in that wood, I put an eye hook, and then I hung a wire, and from that wire I hang that red baseball on the fence, on the cattle pen that's holding up my tomatoes. It looks like a tomato. I put them out before the tomatoes are harvested, so any bird, I have a problem more with cardinals than mockingbirds, and they'll just take one little bite and say, ugh, I don't like this, I'm moving on. But the point is, put those up as decoys. They'll try to get that, put them up in April and May before your first tomatoes. They'll take a peck at that, and they'll say, this is hard as a rock, I can't get any food out of it. Now, people always say, well, does it work? You know, the only way I can really test it is to take them down, and I'm not willing to because I don't have a bird problem when I did this. Some people I've heard put up Christmas tree ornaments, the red ball Christmas tree ornaments, but I never could find one that looked like a tomato. They were always too sparkly and too bright and too frilly looking, so I just made my own, and I'm on, I don't know, seventh year of using them. I've never had to do anything with them, stow them away in the off season, and I just put them back up. People come over and they go, it's maybe April 5th, and they're like, good gosh, how do you have red tomatoes already? I'm like, fooled you. Go over there and squeeze that tomato. So it even fools the human eye. So that's my trick. You can try it if you want, but again, people have said, how do you know it really works? Why don't you take them off and see? I'm like, The tomato, I like my tomatoes. I'm not ready to do a study on my tomatoes. Maybe we'll do them on someone else's, but not mine. Don't mess with my tomatoes.
That's the first time I've heard that technique, but I will definitely try it.
Yeah, great. It's inexpensive, William. I mean, I spent, I don't know, less than $20 on all the equipment. I put up five or six of them, and I put them all the way around, just one or two on each side of the big pen that has all my tomatoes in it. And again, I did that as a one-time purchase. I'm using them every year, never having to touch them up. And let me tell you, that's $20 that I didn't have to go to the store and buy, you know, those tomatoes that come in the grocery store that were picked when they were green and gassed, and then they turn red, and they just taste like you know what.
Right, exactly.
Oh, I don't like it. So I'm a tomato snob. Sounds like you are too. We should maybe let's have a new radio show on tomatoes. How about that?
Yeah, there you go. I grew a variety German Johnson 2 years ago, and the tomatoes went to 2 pounds.
Oh gosh!
And I was watching them, and I couldn't wait to try this tomato. And then an armadillo came in and decided that they were ripe enough for him. If it's not one thing, it's something else. But
that's right.
But no, lately it seems like, you know, I've actually planted 40 tomato plants this past year, and that's just so that I get the birds have some, I get to have some. You know?
Well, that's 40 is a lot. If you know that's
lot,
you're canning a bunch of tomatoes because you can't eat them all. I'll tell you. When I just have 8 big plants, and I have enough where I've got some neighbors that really like us because we'll bring some fresh tomatoes over, or sometimes to the office, I'll take them up to the office. But my wife's gotten really good at canning them as tomato sauce, spaghetti sauce. She'll get herbs and all the other ingredients and can them, and we've got a year's worth of spaghetti sauce that we'll use on variety things. It's just fantastic. And I also love making fresh pico, but that only lasts a day or two. You can't really can good pico. It you have to eat it on the spot, and that's a good problem to have.
let me pass along a technique to you.
Okay.
You take the fresh tomato, you bring it in from the garden, you wash it, you remove the stem, and you put it in a freezer bag. We usually harvest. We'll bring in 20 tomatoes at a time. Mm-hmm. But you just wash the tomato, remove the stem, put it in the freezer bag with the skin on.
Mm-hmm.
Once the tomato is frozen and it's in the fall and you're wanting to make chili or something, whatever, you take the tomato out of the bag, you run it under warm tap water, the peel falls off, and you have a tomato.
Yum. Yum. Well, that's a great tip. Who would have thought on bird calls we'd be talking about cooking and eating? I mean, this is great. Yeah. Hey, William, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
You know what Guy Clark said, there's only two things that money can't buy, yeah, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
That's right. That's a great song.
Oh, I love that song. Give us a call tonight, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. If you'd like to ask Cliff a question, this is Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and he is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and we encourage you to call in tonight. We're having some fun. We do have a caller who didn't want to go on air, but they sent us a question, and that is a caller from Nacogdoches. He wanted to know if the peregrine falcon are related to the common swallow.
Well, so the common swallow, let's just say barn swallow, that's the commonest one that we have in our area. They both have pointy wings. They're both very agile and fast, but they're not very closely related. So, for example, a peregrine falcon is more closely related to a caracara than it is to a swallow. So, no, it's not, but they just have that ability to really streak across the sky like a sports car, I guess. And so that's really all they have in common. But, you know, they don't have a whole lot of else in common. I mean, sure, they're both in the class AVs, but below that, it really gets distant between those two groups. So, but interesting question. Thanks.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Please give us a call, 800-552-8502. If you have a question, that's 800-552-8502. All of our lines are open right now, and we'd love to have your call. So the migratory season is well underway now. What can we expect to be passing through our area over the next month?
Yeah, I think that I've been hearing a lot of people complaining that they don't have birds at their feeders. And this is a common thing I get in the fall. October's a big month to hear that. And we mentioned this the last episode or several that, you know, when we get good rain in the spring and summer, Mother Nature is providing all the stuff they want, insects, berries, nuts, etc. And there you've got your seed feeder that you're really excited about, but the birds aren't. And it's home cooking versus that fast food stuff. So what we're putting out is like fast food versus Mother Nature's doing the home cooking. So, we're going to start seeing some of our feeder birds coming in. Goldfinches will start picking up in the next couple weeks, and pine siskins. They don't really get into big numbers. Now, I didn't say they're not here. I just said that they will start to really increase in the next couple weeks. Chipping sparrows, they're here, but they're really going to increase in numbers. And so what I'm getting at is things will come back to your feeders pretty soon. And you know, the sky is not falling. The ducks, if you're a duck hunter, about November 1st is when mallards, for example, really come in big numbers. So, and as we get deeper into December, they really get higher in numbers. So we're going to start seeing an increase in waterfowl, especially as things get colder to the north. When water starts freezing, that's the environmental cue to go south if you're a water bird or waterfowl in the case of the mallard, and to go south in warmer climate. So, you know, if there's changes in our climate and things aren't freezing up north, and you're a duck, you're not really getting the cue to fly south, there are a lot more ducks that aren't coming down here because of that.
So, what are some of the largest waterfowl that we do get from northern migration?
Well, we'll get a lot of geese that fly over that typically don't winter with us. They're headed to the coast, to the prairies south of us. They don't like the piney woods. Things like greater white-fronted goose, snow goose, cackling goose, and Canada goose, those don't really stick around in big numbers. They're really flying over. And you can tell because right around the time of a big front in the fall, and your windows are open at night, you can sometimes be awakened by snow geese flying overhead going south in the fall. And then we have a huge number of ducks. They're like, if you go, I'll tell you the best place to go in my area is the Ellen Trout Lake right next to the Ellen Trout Zoo in Lufkin. And we've got a couple bird watchers in our Piney Woods Audubon that lead field trips there, Louis Debatez and Les Stewart and others, that is a fantastic place to see ducks. You can get close to a dozen species of ducks, certainly eight or more, easily visible on that one little lake at Ellen Trout Lake on the north side of Lufkin. Buffleheads, gadwalls, shovelers, scop, I mean, just name it. You name it, they're out there. And they're not in the zoo next door. These are wild and wary, free-flying birds that are just using that urban pond or lake as a sanctuary for the winter. It's pretty safe there, and there must be a lot of food because they stick around, and that's a really good place to see waterfowl.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 with your question about our avian world. And we have three calls online. John and Mickey, you're on hold right now. Cynthia, you're up next from Garrison, Texas. Cynthia, you're online. What's your question?
I just wanted to find out how prevalent is the painted bunting in East Texas? I believe I've seen one a couple of times, but it's very rare that you see them, and I was just curious about that.
Yeah, they're hard to see, even though they're super colorful, but once you master the song and you drive around the back roads of your county, there are a lot of painted buntings out there, and they don't start showing up until mid to late April. So you wouldn't do your driving around on April 1st to listen for painted bunnies because they're just not there. But if you go May 15th, they're there. June 1st and so on, they're there. They're singing, and they're hiding in the shrubs. And even though they're bright and colorful, they can hide in the shadows, but they can't hide their loud song. So I would recommend mastering the song of the painted bunting and going out on those dates I mentioned down backcountry roads that have a lot of shrubby, scrubby stuff, maybe a regenerating pine clear cut or an old field, something like that. If it's a grassland where you can see the barbed wire all the way around, that's not painted bunting habitat. If it's a bottomland hardwood forest and there's a creek running through it, a river, that's not painted bunting habitat. But there's a lot of different parts of our area that is painted bunting habitat. There are some lucky people in spring migration that will have millet seed out, and they'll get a painted bunting at their feeder, but it's luck. It's like winning the lottery. I don't mean the millions of dollars on the lottery, but you know, maybe a $10 scratch off or $100 scratch off. It's unusual. And so but I wouldn't count on that happening. So again, just learn the song and go out and try to find one out along the roads, and they're just gorgeous birds. And when did you think you had one, Cynthia?
Oh, it's been several years ago. Yeah. I just remembered it when I heard you talking about it on the birds on the show.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I'm going to call and find out about how prevalent they are, because I've only seen one once or twice.
Yeah, and then they leave in the fall. They're pretty much all gone by now. If we had one right now, it'd be very unusual. They winter in Mexico and points farther south. But they will be back in mid to late April next year. So
thank you very much.
Thanks,
sure
Cynthia.
Appreciate it.
Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call for anything regarding our birds or the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we have Jennifer and Mickey up on hold right now. We're going to go to John next from Longview. John, what's your question tonight?
It sounded like you actually answered it when I was moving from my car to inside, but I had a question about goose migration because I had noticed I haven't heard any geese at night this year. I realize they can be random, but it sounds like we just haven't had enough cold weather from what was saying.
Yeah, I think there have been. I've heard some, and it's just a matter if I'm slightly awake, slightly asleep at night, and the weather's got to be right. And, you know, as we get older, we lose our hearing. That plays a big part in it.
What?
So, yeah. Yeah, here's Bill saying, what? I didn't hear you. So, but it's happening. I mean, there are already geese on the Katy Prairie. That's south of where I live. And those birds have to fly over East Texas to get there. So they're not always vocal when they fly. So it could be, you know, that moment they're over your house, they're dead quiet. Who knows?
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, you got me curious when you were discussing the bird counts earlier. Do the states track the migration of the waterfowl like that as they pass through, or
someplace
you can check on them?
The Christmas counts are a good way to track waterfowl, and you know you have to tie a lot of that to available water, and so a drought year is going to be a problem for a lot of birds. Times when we have big mass production, that's acorns falling on the ground, that those can be really good years, bumper crop years for mallards and wood ducks and those ducks that like to eat mast on the ground or they're floating in the water. But the Christmas bird count is a pretty good way to look at numbers of ducks as they fluctuate. Now, something like a tundra swan, that was a bird that was a regular winter visitor on the coast of Texas, and now it is almost unheard of. And so that's something that you can read in the historical literature on bird abundance and bird occurrence, and it's a thing of the past. And I think a swan is something easy to identify, even if you can't tell a trumpeter from a tundra swan. Just knowing that there were swans of some kind migrating back and forth over our area and wintering on the coast is just, to me, remarkable, because I've never seen a wild and wary swan flying over East Texas. That's just something we're just 100 years too late for that.
Tyler Zoo is the only place I've seen one. So.
Yeah.
One last migratory question.
Uh-huh.
Which, this is obviously a common bird, but we've already had quite a few robins come through here,
uh-huh.
and I haven't really seen the abundance of them the last days or weeks. I don't know whether the bulk of them go ahead and go south and then drift back or what. But
yeah, robins are, that's another thing Christmas bird counts do fairly good job of tracking, numbers of that bird, and they seem to be fairly nomadic, because if you think about what they're predominantly after, and that's berries, things like mistletoe and eastern red cedar and all kinds of different berries, holly. So a lot of that stuff, once you've stripped the bush or tree of its berries, it's going to be another year till it replenishes, right? So that forces birds like robins to be very nomadic. And cedar waxwing's another one that's a berry eater. So we'll see parts of the country that have big numbers of robins and other parts where they're absent.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of these nomadic groups moving through the countryside and stripping that area of all its berries, but then they move on. So a lot of people say, well, how come they didn't stay long? I only had them here for a few days. They got to eat. And think about all those mouths to feed. You don't just sit around and wait. So that forces bird like that to be nomadic.
Mm-hmm. I have a special relationship with cedar waxwings. They strip my neighbor's ligustrum every year and reseed my flower beds.
Oh. Johnny Appleseed.
Yes. So anyway, well, I appreciate your answers.
Okay, thank you, John.
Enjoy hearing it.
Thank you.
It's good to have birds to spread the seeds out there.
Yeah.
You're listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We've got Jennifer and Donnie on hold right now, but we're going to go next to Mickey. Mickey from Shreveport, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, hello, good evening. I have a question about gackles. I used to live in San Antonio, now live in Shreveport.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go over to Bossier, since a new grocery store opened over there earlier this year, whenever I go, there's tons of them there, but it's the only place I see them over there. And I was just wondering, had they been there the whole time? I just never noticed. And would they but they eventually come over to Shreveport. Why are they just around this one area?
Okay, the bird is a grackle. There's an R in there. And the
grackle,
and, yep. Okay. And then the one you're talking about, if it's a parking lot grackle, it's going to be the great tailed grackle.
Okay.
And you said San Antonio, that the I-35 corridor in Texas is just thick with them all the way down, even south of San Antonio into the valley. If you go to Brownsville, McAllen, and Harlingen, they're just thick with great tailed grackles all the way up San Antonio to Austin to Dallas-Fort Worth. Those areas have just been perfect for the for that bird. They like urban settings. They don't really like the piney woods. So they've been fairly new addition in my town in Nacogdoches. There's just a small number. There's a, just a couple of colonies in town, and they just don't seem to be booming. So I'm guessing maybe the same for your area, that they're going to, where you do have them, it's going to be parking lots that are well lit, that have brushy trees, like, oh, they put, you know, the ornamental things that they put in parking lots, lots like Bradford pear. It's a terrible tree. Man, it's beautiful, but it causes that bird, that tree attracts so many birds that then cause problems of, you know, don't park your car under that Bradford pear because there's going to be 700 grackles roosting in there and they're going to poop all over it. So I'm guessing that we're talking about great-tailed grackles and that the parking lot is what's attracting it, and just wait a while. I think they're going to expand, because I'm noticing it in the Nacogdoches area that they've gone from just a few to, you know, a lot more, and I bet my kids are going to see just them that species explode. They just do well in urban areas. The parking lots, they're cleaning off, you know, bugs from our grills that we've hit. They're eating the French fries that we drop, the garbage. They're just doing well with being right next to us humans, just like roaches and rats. They're benefiting from us and our urban settings.
So would that be just a natural progression to move over?
Yeah, I think so. Following I-20 would be a natural progression. So that's similar to I-35, which has a north-south orientation, and that's what's moving. In my opinion, that urbanization is what's moving that bird north. Because if you look at the old literature, in the 1930s and 40s, that bird didn't occur north of San Antonio. So it's moved because of urbanization. Mm-hmm. And in 1950s, when, you know, Texas went from a rural state to an urban state and cities got bigger and we got more parking lots and mowed lawns, well, it just created this mecca for great-tailed grackles.
Okay, cool. Well, I appreciate your time, Cliff, very much.
Okay, thank you, Mickey.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502 with any question concerning our avian world. That's 800-552-8502. And we've got Donnie and Paul on hold right now. Jennifer from Shreveport, you are next. Jennifer, what's your question tonight?
Hi, I just wanted to, we have a hawk problem in our neighborhood, and I have two small dogs that go in and out of a doggy door into our backyard during the day. And so I was, you know, I read online that they don't like reflective light. So I went out and got a disco ball, and I hung it in my backyard, and it seems to be working, but is that a really good way to deter the hawks, or should I be doing something else?
Yeah, you should be doing something else. And I would say, if they're small, are they toy dogs, like a Yorkie?
Anybody
that owns a Yorkie or a toy dog of any kind, you just have to protect them. Hawks aren't the only thing to worry about. You've got coyotes, and the biggest thing are neighbor dogs. Fighting them.
Well, their fence has been pretty good, and we have a lot of trees.
Yeah.
But, you know, I didn't know if there was something, like, should I buy one of those plastic hawks or something?
No, I hate to say it, but I would build more of a kennel that has a roof on it. And it doesn't need to be a metal roof, but a cage roof that a hawk cannot get in. So that way you're protecting your 8-pound dog or your 6-pound dog, because you're just attracting problems. If you've got, you know, there are a lot of those owners that when they walk their dog, it's on a leash, and they're right there on top of them, or they're carrying the dog because they know that the neighbor dog or the coyote or the bobcat
right.
or
yeah,
the great horned owl. I mean, there's so many things that want to eat your dog. It's not just a hawk problem. You've brought in a tasty little morsel, I hate to say it. So as a dog owner, you're going to have to be very protective because you've got something that can't fend for itself against a lot of these bigger predators that I've listed.
Okay, well, thank you for that.
Okay.
And I have one more quick question.
Sure.
I'm teaching the raven to my 8th grade students, and we were looking online at some ravens that talk. And do you happen to know anyone who owns a raven that talks in this area?
No, there was a raven. First of all, you have to have a license to keep a raven.
Right, that's what I was asking.
Yeah, and there was one. It's probably been 20 years at the Heard Museum in McKinney, Texas. That's just north of Dallas, off 75. And they had a raven. No, it was a crow, actually, not a raven. But it would talk. And it would say, oh boy. Just
aww.
As perfect as you can imagine. And he didn't have to do much to get him excited. And he would say, oh boy, in a sweet little voice. And he was really cool. But no, first of all, we don't have ravens in our area. So to get a raven in the wild, you're going to have to drive from Shreveport. You're going to have to drive about 5 or 6 hours west until you're going to pick up your first raven.
Okay.
And then again, I said you got to have a permit to have a raven.
In a zoo or somebody would have to go. Somebody that was licensed to have animals.
Yeah, and that's not a really common bird kept in captivity. This crow at the Heard Museum, and that's spelled H-E-A-R-D, like I heard you talking, that bird was injured and it was being rehabilitated, and it just somebody that...
I'm not looking that online. Okay, yeah.
I don't know if he's still alive. He might be. I don't know how old he was, but in a cage setting like that and taken care of, they can live a long time.
Right.
But so the answer to your question is you're probably going to have better luck finding the pot at the end of a rainbow, pot of gold. How about that?
Okay, that's
yeah, why don't you look for the pot of gold? That'll be easier to find.
Go raven hunting and you'll find the pot of gold.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks, Jennifer.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. Paul, you're on hold, and Donnie, you're up next from Joaquin, Texas. Donnie, what's your question?
I noticed all through this spring and summer, there's a bird out here that basically calls. It sounds like he's saying, do it. About every 4 or 5 seconds, and he'll do that for an hour. I've never heard that before, but I spent the last 20 years in South Korea, where there's very few birds over there.
Yeah.
And coming back to home here in East Texas, I'm hearing lots of birds I don't remember growing up.
Yeah. Well, it's a tough one. What I'd recommend, Donnie, is if you have a cell phone, you can use your video feature, and just don't worry about what it's taking a picture of, but use the microphone and try to capture that do it sound and then send that to us in the future. It doesn't have to be right away. So if you don't hear that until March, April, May, do it then, and you can call back in June and we can talk about it then. You'll want to send it to us before the show so we can cue it up and listen to it and try to figure it out. But we're going to need a recording of that. Even one that's fuzzy will work with a cell phone. But I'm assuming you can get close enough that you can get capture some kind of sound from it.
Try not to hold the cell phone either. Just take it out there and maybe set it on something and walk away. They'll become more active if you're not out there.
Yeah.
And they don't know cell phones from anything. So that's how I record with my phone or my little recorder. I walk away and I'll come back 15, 20 minutes later, see what I have.
Yeah.
Well, these are out there while I'm working in the garden or the greenhouse.
Okay, so they're really busy and active and not bothered by you. Yeah.
They don't care nothing about me. It's like I'm busting my tail trying to get something done.
Yeah.
These birds are out there, and I'm serious. It sounds just like they're saying, do it.
Okay.
Do it.
They're telling you to get that garden going. Well, so you've got another homework assignment, not just the gardening, but now you got to get your recorder ready to get a future recording, and then we can talk again, Donnie. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay, thank you, sir.
They might be channeling your father from when you was a boy, too.
Yeah, so that's right. Yeah, I've got some kids I sure wish I could put the do-it bird over them when it's time to do homework and chores.
Yeah.
All right, thanks, Donnie.
Thank you.
All right, you can give us a call at 800-552-8502 if you'd like to get your question into Cliff. We still have a little time. 800-552-8502. Any question about our avian world? We go next to Paul from Nacogdoches. Paul, you're online. What's your question?
Okay, thank you. Thanks for having me. I used to do some work up in Chicago, and that was when Mayor Washington was the mayor. And that's when all those green parrots started invading Chicago and flying in uniform, a bunch of, like, 35 of them would fly in back of a car, and they would look exactly like the car that was preceding them. And then another car would be right in back of them, and they were the strangest birds I've ever seen, and they would fly in formation, and somebody told me they came from Mexico in a truck, and somebody dumped them near Lake Michigan, and they invaded the Chicago area. I was just wondering if you knew what they were and if they came to this area or anywhere in the United States, would there be a problem with their proliferation? I know there was a lot of parrots in America before everybody destroyed them. So I was just wondering if they would do harm or
right.
Would they blend in or what?
Right. You know? So our native parrot that you alluded to is the Carolina parakeet, and they are all gone. They've been gone for about 100 years. But the bird you're talking about that has colonized Chicago, which is, you think of cold Chicago in the winter, and this bird's not migratory. It's the monk parakeet. It's also called a Quaker. So the aviculturists, those that are in the cage bird industry, they call them Quakers, but the ornithologists call them monk parakeets. They're not from Mexico. They're from temperate South America, so central and southern Brazil.
They're very aggressive.
Yeah, they're aggressive. they're in Argentina. I was in Argentina back in April, and I've never seen more monk parakeets in my life than along the Atlantic coast there in Argentina, in the Punta Ross area. They're just everywhere. And they build these giant stick nests. They're communal nests.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They're the size of a refrigerator, or maybe a dorm fridge at first if there are a few pairs, or even larger if there's a bigger group. And they're made of fine sticks that are, you know, roughly the size of a number two pencil, maybe a little thinner than that.
There was a park in Chicago, Washington Park, and they took over every telephone pole and built the nest you're talking about all around the electrical wires. And, you know, a lot of people loved them and a lot of people hated them. And there was a big uproar about it.
Yeah, the people that hate them are the electric companies because their nests can create arcing and brownouts and blackouts. Mm. So it's a problem. The bird's not native to the U.S., so there's no protection. So those companies, and cell towers, another one where they build nests, those companies can come in and remove the nests and not need a permit because the bird is not protected because it's not native. But they don't want to do it in a flashy time and advertise it because there are a lot of people that think they're cool. They're in the Austin area. Austin has probably the biggest population in my state of Texas. There are also some in the White Rock Lake area of Dallas. There's some in Houston and Corpus, but Austin has the biggest population. They've been there since the 70s, and people let them go. They did not get here on their own. And the reason they can survive places like Chicago in the winter is because they're from temperate South America where they have seasons, including cold winters. So most parrots we think of are tropical and can't deal with cold weather. And for the most part, that's true, but this species can tolerate cold, and that's why they're in Chicago. So I have a question for you, Paul. Why did you mention the mayor of Chicago in this discussion?
Well, because Mayor Washington, he had an apartment across from this park.
Uh-huh.
And he was the one that actually wanted to protect these birds
okay.
at the very beginning. He liked them, evidently.
Yeah. Was he African-American man?
Yeah, he was.
I remember that.
He was a really robust type character.
I remember that because I remember seeing articles about that, and that's why I asked you about the mayor, because that's exactly who was being featured in this. And, you know, normally the mayor of a town has nothing to do with the discussion, but I just thought that was interesting because it's probably been 30 years since I read that article.
Well, my question was, what if they came down in the East Texas area? Wouldn't that be a even better environment for them?
Well, I don't know. I think that in Austin, they really like the lights of ballparks. You'll see them. And actually, the ballparks have had to figure out new ways of designing lights to not encourage those birds to build nests. They go to feeders. They eat acorns. I don't know if they would do well in the piney woods. So that's a good question. But I don't think we need to find out. I think we've got enough birds here. I don't want to be encouraging people to make those introductions here like they've done in Chicago and Austin.
You've been listening to Bird Calls, and we're going to conclude our program tonight. I can't speak with our annual or our monthly conservation tip from Cliff. What have you got for us this month?
Okay, we're going to close out with a conservation tip on nuisance woodpeckers. So if you hear this sound in the great outdoors, keep in mind that it's a form of communication in certain birds. Here we go. Drumming. Let's listen one more time. There we go. So just like the tapping sounds of Morse code used to communicate, it's believed that woodpeckers drum both to inform others of their species that this is their territory and attract and maintain a mate. Drumming is also called rapping or tattooing and can be done on a natural or artificial surface that really resonates. A hollow limb, for instance, is what Mother Nature has provided them. Drumming might sound destructive, but it doesn't damage that metal roof or rain gutter telephone pole. But if you see nest holes in that telephone pole, that's a different woodpecker action called excavating. Excavating involves a much slower and harder blow by the woodpecker's bill that enables the bird to chip away at the wood. If you have woodpeckers excavating roosting or nesting holes on the side of your wooden house or outbuilding, instead of resorting to drastic action like shooting them for it, which is an illegal activity, by the way, instead consider placing the appropriate sized birdhouse where the damage is taking place. Woodpeckers often resort to using a birdhouse at the very spot they've selected instead of continuing to excavate. So for details and birdhouse blueprints suitable for different size classes of woodpeckers, Google the following keywords: woodpecker damage simple solution. For a Texas Parks and Wildlife booklet that will help guide you to a truce between you and any woodpecker that is causing you trouble. The birdhouse says you're willing to accommodate your feathered neighbors. Do it for the birds.
You've been listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we want to thank Cliff for joining us tonight. It's always a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, this was fun. We got on a big tangent of tomatoes, and I hope that's okay with the listeners, but food's pretty doggone important, isn't it?
Well, especially to me and to birds.
Yeah, that's right.
They kind of like that, too. So you've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford. He is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and our statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We want to thank everybody at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help on this program, and I want to personally thank Cliff for joining us tonight. Bird Calls is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. The producer for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford. We had help tonight with Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Tim Schnell. And the audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in the next few hours at redriverradio.org. This is Red River Radio, and we are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado, Magnolia, and KLDN, Lufkin, Nacogdoches. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is next here on Red River Radio.